We're back. Ron Chernow is our guest, and we were talking about John Rockefeller as perhaps the guy who invented the 20th century.
Well, he probably could lay as good a claim as anyone else to that. You know, the irony is that here's a man who was very much a 19th century character in terms of he's an old-fashioned fire and brimstone Baptist who didn't smoke, he didn't drink, he didn't gamble, he didn't go to the theater.
A Puritan.
He was the last Puritan.
No dancing.
No dancing.
No cards.
He didn't have any fun at all.
He's
repressed. He has this very formal Victorian marriage. I mean, in so many respects, he's a quintessential 19th century man. Except in his business and his philanthropy, he is creating forms that are amazingly modern. He has to figure out a way to create a multinational corporation. He creates...
Before they existed,
he has to figure out how to create a trust and a holding company. You know that at the time, in the late 19th century, businesses headquartered in one state were not allowed to own stock in businesses headquartered in another state. He has to figure out first just how to create a national company and then an international company. He then, you know, has all of these dozens of different constituent companies. He has to figure out a way to coordinate their activities. So he comes up with a very elaborate committee system so that they could, you know, share information. He actually gets competitions going among the different parts of it, all of this headed by an executive committee structure. And so that there are a lot of, you know, business historians and management experts, you know, who look at Standard Oil and say, here for the first time, we begin to see an organization chart and structure that looks like that of a modern corporation. Same thing happens in the world of philanthropy. He suddenly has so much money that the old kind of, you know, doing it out of your hip pocket approach doesn't work. In fact, he almost has a nervous breakdown in the 1890s because his chief philanthropic advisor said, Mr. Rockefeller was hunted and stalked like a wild animal. Everywhere he went, people were approaching him for money. In fact, every single time it was in the newspaper that he had given away a large amount of money, he would receive on average, 50,000 letters begging for money within the next 4 weeks. It reached the point where if people would just clip his photo out of the newspaper anywhere in the world, put it on an envelope, put a stamp on the envelope, and just put it in the mailbox without his name or without his address, it would go straight to John D. Rockefeller. So the same way that kids write to Santa Claus, care of the North Pole, they would write to, you know, John D. Rockefeller, USA, you know, and it would go straight to... Okay,
meticulous as he was, he wanted to respond to all 50,000 every 4 weeks.
You know, he was very sincere. He wanted to do this intelligently, and here he faces this tidal wave of requests. So just as in Standard Oil, he had to create new corporate forms. In philanthropy, he creates, you know, one of the first great foundations. This was a novelty in the early 20th century. The idea of assembling boards of prominent citizens, the idea of recruiting expert opinions to give grants and operate programs, all of these things that we now take for granted were brand new and had to be invented at a certain point. And he and Andrew Carnegie were without question the two leading people in creating not only the modern corporation, but the modern nonprofit world, which is a very big part of our society that we take for granted.
And another little piece, as you talk about Carnegie, is that I have a great fondness in my heart for Carnegie libraries, but they are always Carnegie libraries.
Right.
And Rockefeller also had this amazing instinct to give money away anonymously.
Yeah, this is a very interesting point because in Rockefeller's papers, you could see there's a lot of discussion that Carnegie wants his name emblazoned across every library, and so they thought that there was a lot of vanity. In fact, when Carnegie would endow a new library in England, he would ride in state in an open carriage through the streets, and he actually received the freedoms of more cities in the United Kingdom than anyone, I think, including Winston Churchill and
the
Gladstone.
Freedoms?
The freedom to get freedom of the city would be an honor.
Oh, as it
is. It's like the keys to the city.
Keys to the kingdom. Got it.
Yeah, Carnegie got more than Winston Churchill. So that he did use it, whereas Rockefeller would never have dreamed of appearing in public. In fact, when he created the University of Chicago, he didn't even visit the campus for the first 5 years. He refused to allow it to be called Rockefeller University, just as he didn't want Spelman College called Rockefeller College, both of which would have been easy options. He did this, I think, in part out of an old-fashioned religious tradition that the best giving is anonymous giving. It was also that there were a couple of other things, because I don't want to, you know, glorify him here. It was self-protect active. The more times his name appeared, the more he was besieged with what he called the begging letters. And so he just couldn't live after a point. Other thing, which may have been the most important thing to him, he didn't want to create dependency. And he felt that as soon as he put his name on an institution, everybody else stopped giving to the institution. And so to call the University of Chicago Rockefeller University, he would never have gotten out of there. The Rockefeller family would still be supporting it to this day.
But there is a great research institution that is Rockefeller.
Yeah, that was one of the few exceptions, and I'm still to this day not certain why he allowed that exception. I think that the reason was that the University of Chicago, though it was a great success, and almost overnight it becomes a school on par with the Ivy League colleges, they were actually...
That's because they bought their professors from the Ivy League colleges.
It was the greatest talent raid ever, and they depleted the ranks of Cornell, Yale, Princeton, all these other schools. There were actually 9 former college presidents on the first faculty of the University
Start
of Chicago.
Small.
So there was a lot of resentment among the other schools about that. I think what happened, though, the University of Chicago got out of hand because he did want to start small. And he had this very, very gifted, somewhat megalomaniacal president, William Rainey Harper, who just kept expanding and expanding and running giant deficits. This was in the 1890s. When Rockefeller starts this first medical research institute in the United States ever, what's today the Rockefeller University, he kept saying, let's start small this time and really control the expenditures. And I think that he therefore deliberately put his name on it because he wanted to control it. And he wanted to control it because the University of Chicago, which seems such a great visionary feat, was to Rockefeller's mind at various moments this nightmarish project that just kept growing and growing and taxing even his considerable resources.
An educational trust.
That's right. He wanted to create an educational trust. And in the early days, there were even plans for the University of Chicago, sending professors out to other schools in the Midwest. And, you know, the people who surrounded Rockefeller were aware that the quickest way to his heart was to describe some project as a trust. So if you said this would be like an educational trust, where if we build this church, it would be like a religious trust, then suddenly you were talking his language, and these were principles that he could respect, because he always felt that it was better to have a few strong institutions than a lot of small, scattered ones.
We've said a good deal about the good that he did,
yeah,
and his imagination. We have not spoken of the less than good that he did.
Evil,
too. Part of it seems, he was challenged by the inadequacy of the current institutions, and he was inventing things. He also seemed to have a remarkable ability to rationalize and justify what was in his own best interest. And
yeah, absolutely.
And it appears that that's sort of what led him astray.
Yeah, you know, this is what amazed me when I came upon the 1,700-page interview that he had done, that he'd spent an enormous amount of time rationalizing to himself what he had done and trying to reconcile his religious behavior with his business behavior, which took a stretch. And so he has, because he feels that he has God on his side, he has this unshakable certitude that makes him very hard to beat. Because he feels that he has God on his side, he also is dangerously immune to criticism. There's an element of fanaticism in the whole thing. Rockefeller faced a situation in the late 1860s. He was in his late 20s. He was already very wealthy from oil refining. Suddenly, as would happen throughout the history of oil, there is an oil surplus. The price skids. It skids below the cost of production. He doesn't see the refiners cutting back, and he doesn't see the drillers cutting back, and the price keeps sinking lower. At that point, very significant turning point, not only in his life, but in the life of the country, he despairs of free market capitalism. He despairs of competition. He doesn't see the invisible hand correcting the excesses.
The invisible hand being Adam Smith.
The invisible hand being Adam Smith, and the whole idea that, you know, the markets correct themselves. He doesn't see that happening. He sees the crisis deepening. And so he begins to champion what he calls cooperation and what the rest of the world would prefer to call trusts
and monopolies.
And so at this point, he realizes that he wants to suspend the laws of supply and demand and actually control the entire industry. Once he has convinced himself that this is the only way to save the industry, he is at the same time an amazingly resourceful and tenacious man. He's also a dangerous man. He's a man with a mission, and nobody's going to stand in his way. He feels that he sees...
Well, there's a crusader and has, you know, almost messianic quality to this.
Very messianic quality, absolutely.
I mean, he is going to make the world safe for oil, and, oh, by the way, it is God's will that that is as it should be.
Yeah, and in fact, what amazed me going through his papers, that the terminology that he used to justify this was patently religious terminology. He said, I told the other refiners, my brethren, come into the ark with me. You are in a slough of despond. You know, we will save you. So that there's no question that he converted Standard Oil into a kind of annex of the Baptist Church. And it's very interesting because the world looked at him and saw him as a corporate criminal, and they felt that they were the virtuous reformers who were criticizing him. He had a completely inverted worldview. He saw himself as a virtuous man who was surrounded by all of these scheming and blackmailing rivals, as he used to refer to them. And so he had this completely upside-down view of the world.
We're talking about John Rockefeller. We're talking with his biographer, Ron Chernow. Bill Russell and I urge you to stay with us. We're going to be back in just a moment.